I do not want the fact that I have actually licked the three cappuccino cheesecake pieces deter you from enjoying a piece if that's your favorite flavor. Don't let that stand in your way.
I saw it too.
You know where you go for lying. We'd like to offer you a choice. We have it on the schedule for the day, and the choice is very much yours. If you'd like to carry on with the fourth section of concert, the outline is on the board. We're quite content, Kathy and I, to scrap this and open it up for some questions you have, or concerns, or an experience that you'd like to share, insights about this whole area of gender stuff, boy-girl stuff, marriage stuff that we've completely overlooked. What would you like? Gordon?
How about a compromise? A compromise, start with some questions and answers maybe for a certain period of time, and I know there may not be enough time to cover the whole of that, but give us the highlights then. I mean, it's just a suggestion. And if there were no questions and answers, then fine.
Okay. It's, of course, very possible there might be questions and no answers. Would you like to do that? Okay. I know that's what you're all thinking. So some of the stuff, I guess, is getting on the tape. Do you have some questions at all from what we said so far? Or if you've peeked ahead to 7 and 8? For me, it is amazing stuff as we've gotten deeper into it. Song of Solomon, like all of Scripture, it's very much like mining. It's an analogy that's used in Scripture. But occasionally you meet a few flakes on the surface, a few gold flakes and so on. But to hit the mother lode, no, you've got to go down and down and further down. Take some digging, some sweat, some hard work. And initially it was very confusing, 7 and 8, and then some things began to stand out for me, and now we've toyed around with it for quite a while, and 7 and 8 are now very, very exciting. As Kathy and I mentioned, I think we say in our manual that we read the Song of Solomon actually on the first night of our honeymoon. That's where it all got started. And my keenest memories of our first night together as husband and wife, I read chapters 1, 3, 5, and 7, and Kathy read 2, 4, 6, and 8. And she read hers very, very carefully and thoughtfully, and I kind of raced through mine. But we've revisited the song, and it's now become a pretty special book. But questions on what we've said or failed to say so far?
Mm. But you mentioned that you and Kathy had agreed never to use the word divorce. I don't know whether we formally agreed to that. We might have, but it just wasn't in our vocabulary either. And I think that's kind of interesting. And I remember our neighbor about 10 years ago, who's not a Christian, and she just commented out of the blue one day. She looked at her wedding pictures and looked at the bridal party and said, half of them are divorced. And she said, what's happened? People don't have a commitment anymore.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very good suggestion. That when people start off, if they can agree to never mention that word, it's not a fallback position.
Yeah. And it's partly, I'll just run a little bit with that and then give some others a chance to ask a question or two. But I see the main reason for that, the main reason for, this may surprise you, the main reason for the lack of commitment is that North America is the continent in the world, it's that place in the world that has done the most poorly at developing a theology of suffering. It's horrendous in its absence or denial of a theology of suffering. But the reigning mantra on the street is to maximize pleasure and minimize pain. Pleasure is always good for me, pain is always bad for me. Rubbish. Rubbish. You came into the world associated with pain. And pain will be there as your teacher. Who's the man? Rohr, Richard Rohr. Catholic man that I really admire. I've got two of his tapes, 84 minutes each. 84 minutes each. On the theological, spiritual journey of a man. That's one tape, and I have a woman, the other. And he says about men, he says, let's face it, men. Success has very little to teach us after the age of 30. After the age of 30, suffering is our main and our most effective teacher. See, but if you don't have a theology of suffering, and the minute the relationship is a bit distant or painful, she doesn't meet my needs, he's failed to meet my expectations, and you cast about for the next one who will do better than the first one. And the American figures are in that people fail in 47% of their first marriages and 62% of their second marriages.
And it goes up with each one.
Yep. Yep. So I'm learning something from the first time. Again, nonsense. No, it's the same old me, and I expect her or him to be different. So it's all the way back in Genesis. It's not about finding the right person. It's about being the right person, right? You do the being, God does the finding. That's Genesis 2. But develop a theology of suffering. The rest of the world knows about that. North America does not. Oh. I mentioned to your group, I think, I was kind of ranting away for a while. there's 53 African countries. We visited about half. And the AIDS epidemic, a little sidebar, free of charge. The two things that are killing Africa are aid and AIDS. Okay? Aid and AIDS are killing the place. Okay, but AIDS, 39.6% HIV positive in KwaZulu-Natal, where we're 8 weeks every year. So one out of two death sentence on their heads. And all kinds of spin-offs, like University Department of Agriculture can use 100 new applicants. And they say welcome, they accept 200, knowing that 100 will die. Well, that's so only two countries are making progress in AIDS, Senegal, Uganda. Senegal has never been above 2%. Uganda went from 17 to 8 in the last 10 years. Why? These are the only two transparent countries in Africa. They talk about sex openly. They say, here's how you contract AIDS. These things will not get you into AIDS. This is how to recognize it. Here's what to do about it. And if the death sentence is here, here's how we can help you to die with dignity. And most countries are saying, the one place that can help you to die with dignity better than anyone else is the local church. But these two countries are transparent. They walk in the light. Yoweri Museveni, president of Uganda, at Makerere, started in 1924, huge university, 15% Christians. And he told in his graduating address, 19, 89. He said, this is AIDS. It's going to ravage our country. Here's how to recognize it. Here's what to do about it. Well, they went from 17 to 8. Thabo Mbeki, a few countries to the south, AIDS, problem? What problem? And South Africa is riddled with AIDS because they would refuse to acknowledge. So transparency is simply 1 John 1. It's walking in the light. Zimbabwe will be there again 6 weeks next year. Nobody dies of AIDS. Every death certificate you see in Buluwayo, Harare, Mutare, Gweru, all these places, you die of TB. Nobody dies of AIDS. So yeah, what you say is personally good for the folks you hang out with at Rosemont, but on the national, political, and continental scale, it's the winner or loser in the struggle against AIDS. So 1 John 1 has a lot to say. If you belong to him, you walk in the light. Have I stolen your thunder?
No. I want to say something else. I do have a few thousand words left, you know.
I was just thinking about the balance of transparency with the Daughters of Jerusalem, that, you know, finding, when you're actually really going through it, like, you have to be a little careful, because not everybody, I used to talk about when I was a pastor's wife, the burden of confidentiality. It's like, some people cannot bear the burden of confidentiality. They will promise you they will keep you your, what you've shared to themselves, but they can't. You know, I think some, even on elder boards, that happens, that some wives can bear the burden of confidentiality and some wives can't. You know, you probably have seen it on your board here. But I think that's part of it, to find the Daughters of Jerusalem. So, like, a lot of the things that I'm talking about in my relationship with Hank today, I can talk about them in the past, you know, because we've worked through it. But when I was going through them, I wouldn't have announced it to the whole church, because I also have to think about him. You know, I have to honor him. Does he want me to share everything about our marriage with the whole church? You know, so I think there's just that, you know, Holy Spirit, the gift of, I don't want to misuse the reference, but there is a discernment for sure around who actually are my Daughters of Jerusalem. But once it's happened, then it can really be helpful. And my biggest example of that was when we first came to Montreal. We had left our son behind in British Columbia. He was 18, and he had decided not to move with us from British Columbia to Montreal. So, but he was not in a good place. Like, he'd had a tough time as a teenager with his dad as a pastor, and some, you know, some, you can imagine, PKs sometimes have a tough time. And so he had sort of decided, well, if Christians are people that don't smoke or drink, then that's what I must do, because I don't want to be part of them. That's kind of the stage of where he was in his life. Well, it was pretty scary. We used to pray for him that he would not kill anybody or himself if he was drinking and driving. You know, and a few weeks ago when we had this Île Perrot accident, I said, you know, really, it's God's mercy that it doesn't happen more often, because there's so many kids who are in that place. But I remember, because I didn't know everybody at Westview, and yet my heart was so heavy, I felt like I had a hole in my heart, because it was just like I'd left my firstborn son behind, and he was in a bad place. So I felt like I had a hole in my heart. So I put it on the prayer chain to say, you know, please pray for Hank and Kathy's son in British Columbia. And I had looked at all those people at Westview, oh, these fine, upstanding families. You know, I was so embarrassed and ashamed that I have this problem. And as soon as I shared it, I would have people come and say, you know, we really sympathize, because our son this or that, our daughter that and that. And I discovered actually was a knitting together with those people who now are still very close friends of mine, because we have shared the tough things of life. So there's that balance of the when of maybe when you're transparent, but it's so much healthier if we can find that balance of when to share, and but then to share to say, you know what, this is life. Yeah. Thanks, Joy. Good point. I know there is one question about
Let me add one quick comment. We've counseled toward marriage, and we've actually married about 30 couples. And that long stretch for us, the rules of the game are changing a bit. So the next couple that will approach us, and we've suggested it to others, we're going to insist on it now. That's where we've changed, is that they will be asked to select an older couple from their church family that they admire and respect, who can have access to the marriage at least once a month for the first year. And that couple gets the green light to talk about finances, in-laws, sex, the big three that are talking points and friction points. Talk about the sex or the in-laws, the outlaws, and finances. These are the three things that we stumble over. And at least once a month for 12 months, they have the green light for access into that relationship. And if a young couple says, hey, we don't need that. We love each other. All we need is each other. I would say, well, find somebody else. Yeah. I would say, well, find someone else who will take your $100 for the ceremony, but I'm not going to have this on my conscience. You need somebody else to guide you through the shoals of that first year together. So we're getting a little bit hard-nosed about that area. Get a mentoring couple so that four of you cruise through the first year and give you some hope for the second. You were asked.
Sounds like the Garden of Eden, doesn't it? You. But you do it so much better. We were just talking in the break about the Song of Solomon 6, verse 8. The 60 queens there may be, and 80 concubines and virgins beyond number. Semicolon, but my dove, my perfect one, is unique. And as we see it, I mean, this always becomes a stumbling block for us because we know the stories of, you know, the biblical story of what happened to Solomon. And so it always troubles us, like, what is he saying? And we like to, we feel that Song of Solomon was probably the first book that he wrote, like when he was a young man. And that Proverbs was written more the middle, and then at the end of his life, the time of his sarcasm and cynicism and skepticism was Ecclesiastes. And it's like we almost had the feeling that he's one of those guys that probably started well, but, you know, that book Finishing Strong, he did not finish strong. And that this thing, which is, and I think we were talking about that, Patty, that, I mean, we know that was the cultural context that he lived in, was that as a king, first of all, he inherited all of his father's wives and concubines. He would have been responsible for all of those women. And there's even belief that the woman here is Abishag. Do you remember who Abishag is? She was the young virgin who slept with David to keep him warm. And there's a belief that because when Solomon became king, his brother wanted to take Abishag, wanted to take her as his. And Solomon, is almost like Solomon said, I know what you're doing here. You know, you want to take this woman as, you know, the king's wife. You want to take her. It was like it was a power play that was going on. But there's a feeling that was the one. But it's so sketchy, no one knows anything for sure about that. But the fact is he inherited them. The other fact is, which I think you probably already know, Patty, those of you who are in that group, was that part of forming an alliance with another country was to take that guy's daughter into your palace as a wife. Because if his daughter is in your palace, he's not going to be very quick to take your palace, you know, or to destroy your palace, because he'll destroy his own daughter. So there's no doubt that a lot of those girls that were never slept with, but they were political alliances. Can you imagine how hopeless that would have been to be the king's daughter, and you never will know the joy of marriage. You'll just be, you know, a kept woman in a palace because you're in a political exchange. So there's some horrible things when you think of it from that standpoint. But at some point, we do know that Solomon made a terrible mistake in starting to, you know, be faith to be involved with more than one woman, with these wives. And so that's the sadness. But it's like we say about Paul, as far as we know, all right, Paul was never married. But we take Paul's advice about marriage. So we don't say, well, he's not married. So what does he have to tell us about marriage? We know that what Paul is saying is godly. It's godly wisdom. And I think that's what we realize about Song of Solomon, is that this is godly wisdom. And regardless of what happened to him later in his life, which is not our model, the book itself is still inspired and still speaks to us. So that's kind of how we, you know, how we see it. And that's why I think we just really see it. It's got God's inspiration, and there's real power in it. So I don't know if that totally answers, but it's, you know, where we sort of felt, the view we felt to take on it. How'd I do? Yes, please.
In my head, something I struggle with is something God kind of revealed to me is I struggle with, well, if it's written in the Bible, does that mean he endorses it? And kind of the answer I got was no. He's not saying he's endorsing it. And the Bible is filled with stories about people who made mistakes.
Yeah.
And the fact that God doesn't cover it up and take out all the things that, yeah, David did wrong and everything, clean it up, sanitize the Bible,
yeah,
to make all his people look perfect, is actually a way of God not endorsing it, but showing us that we're also flawed.
Yeah.
And that he still uses us with our own mistakes.
Yeah.
So it's not an endorsement, but he's being real about,
yeah,
who his people were and who used them.
Yeah. It's an excellent point. Very, very well spoken.
Yeah, let me amplify that point. It was well made, well stated. I can see why you're in leadership. But there's steles, S-T-E-L-E, you know, old stone tablets that are available to us describing the same battle. It's the same place, the same year, as far as we can figure out the years. The same battle, but there's separate archaeological tools that we have indicating that both sides of the battle won, both kings won. It's from this part and he won. It's from this part, another part of the Middle East, and he won. And to what extent is history reliable? Well, the Bible is totally refreshing in all of ancient literature in that every single saint has feet of clay. And the Bible has just a gentle way of underscoring that the only perfect person in this story is God. The only one you can run to and rely on is God. Everybody else has flaws, and serious flaws. Serious flaws. I mean, in one afternoon, David broke 5 of the 10 commandments. 5 of the 10 commandments in one afternoon. And next January, I'll be in Capenray. We'll be in Capenray teaching leadership principles from the life of David. And I'll tell them on Sunday night in the intro time that, in a way, this is really embarrassing. It is really embarrassing. Why? Because the rest of the year, we teach marriage and family. That's what we do all over Africa. We do marriage and family stuff, you know, trying to... they're on a heavy slide of marriages falling apart, coming unglued in Africa because they're following us, they're imitating us to a large extent. I can explain why, but drop that for now. But African marriages are not doing well, families not doing well. But then I say David, and not by any remote stretch of the imagination is he a model for a godly husband. He has 8 wives. And none of them would nominate David as the greatest husband they've ever known. And he had 21 children, 20 sons and 1 daughter. And none of them would claim that he's the dad of a lifetime. Each one of the 21 would say, if we could trade him in for another model, we'd be the first off the mark. He's a lousy husband, he's a lousy father, and yet he's a man after God's own heart. Go figure. See, but it's a very earthy human story. The only one that emerges without smudges or flaws is God. So, anyone else? Yeah.
I just get believed that the words that you speak wisely, Let me say before he has to say it that this is in public.
May I also say that you just spoke about 20 words too many. Did you give Mark card? Yeah, Peter.
A question going back a couple sessions. In the first chapter, basically sort of verses 5 to 7 or so, when you talked about 3 points of tension and then the one quality or characteristic that sort of ties together. Can you go over the third pair, tension pair again? The one that had to do with the woman's sort of self-perception and having to do with her appearance, but what she had to offer, something like that. Can you go over that again?
Sure.
Most people probably got that.
No, I'll try to say that in as few words as possible. There's the chemistry and the reputation. That's the first two. Chemistry and reputation. The heart has to be involved. The mind has to be involved. The second is you get to know him one-on-one. You get to know him in community. We do the one-on-one stuff very well in the West. Africa does the community stuff very well in Africa. Very well. We have students, I'm rambling again, but we have students come to us, Nesbert Marisa a few years ago. Mr. and Mrs. Pot, please congratulate me. So, Makarakoto, congratulations. I am engaged to be married. I said, well, who is she? I said, you guess. And we guessed 2, 3, 4 ladies that we thought might be candidates, wrong each time. They can hide as they watch and observe very carefully. Africans are so good at this. They watch a young lady in community, and don't hustle her off one-on-one, but in community, how does she react, respond? Is she loud, insistent on her own opinions? Does she pick up on the person who's getting overlooked in conversation, the wallflower, and all kinds of things, and then they slowly move in and say, can we spend a bit more time together? So we had no clue, we usually don't, who Africans were committed to marry. Not a clue, because they date in community. Dating as we know it is anathema, not the one-on-one. So that's the alone and together. Then the third is what I call, she's both apprehensive and assertive. So another way to put that, apprehensive, I am dark, don't stare at me. But assertive, I'm lovely. And there's a reason for my physical appearance. So what she does, this may be a more helpful way to grab it, is not only that she is apprehensive, there's a winsome honesty and candor there. She's also assertive. She's not a doormat, whatever you say, dear. So the two things that she doesn't say, I am somebody. Or the other, I'm just a nobody. She avoids both. And if you want a healthy wife, you don't want, I'm somebody, or I'm just a nobody. You know, you want somebody who avoids those two traps and travels saying, I'm apprehensive. There's parts of me that are not maybe on the list that you're looking for or in somebody to marry, as far as appearance and heritage. And Solomon's, the banner over this girl is love. And the banquet tables are filled with conversation. Who is she? Where is she from? Well, she's from Lebanon. Well, what royalty is she related to? Actually, she works in the vineyard. She what? No, she's got no pedigree, no status. But what they can't argue with is that Solomon has chosen her. That's her trump card. Solomon has chosen me. And you see the church there too. what trump card do we have to play with God except that he's chosen us? So you avoid the extremes of, I'm somebody, God must be delighted that I'm on his team, or that I'm just a nobody. So it's that mix that I see in her in chapter one already. Does that help a bit more? Good, good question. Honey, she has a question for you.
Would be, what is your take on what would you be saying to teens in terms of one-on-one dating? I mean, it's a huge topic, working with teens. Mm-hmm. They all want their boyfriends and girlfriends, and it's kind of out of style to say to them, dating is not wise, or I don't even know what, like, what would your take be on it?
Thanks. I actually think that, I mean, I can give you a few things, but really, you know, you're going to know better than I, you know, how to deal with that. But I think that what this generation does do is they do hang out in groups as well. And I think that, to me, is a key thing, is just really encouraging them to stay in the group. We, in the last talk, this one, we'll talk about that, the value of groups of three or more. So that it gives you just that, it keeps you from that exclusive relationship that puts you in danger and puts you in trouble. So, hey, you know, it's like, hey, do you mind if my friend comes along? And if that's a problem for a guy that you want your friend to come along, well, it tells you something about what his intentions are. We always encourage that. And if you can begin to develop that culture within the church, youth, to say, hey, we don't do stuff one-on-one. We try and do stuff in groups. We try and include as many people as we can, that you can at least do, you can make an attempt at least to make a difference that way. To me, that's a big one, and my mind has just gone blank to what else I was going to say. Oh, you have something.
Stay here. You probably have more. A couple of reasons, there's many, but a couple of reasons that I think dating is unbiblical and ought to be. Okay. Yeah.
You're just giving us something to argue about. Right?
Discuss. A new conflict. Yay. Discuss. 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 Yeah. 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 Yeah, that's the place to start. Why does she feel this way? Why does she feel this way? That's where to start, right? It's all about you, not it's all about me. But the dating stuff, we do not see in Africa. And in our circle of Christian friends in Africa, we've seen one divorce in 10 years. And we've hung out between 800 and 1,000 young African students in a number of marriages. One divorce in 10 years. And a couple things, there's others that come to mind, but I'll mention two, is that it puts way too much unfair emphasis on the outside at the expense of the inside, so that some girls come wrapped in a very attractive package, and even the ribbon looks good, and other girls who have a lot to contribute, a lot to give, they're gold on the inside, but a guy can't get past the plain package. Seeing if there's two young girls who are roommates, and if you know your young people, Friday night is critical. You do not want to be alone on Friday night. At all costs, come heaven or hell, you do not want to be alone on Friday night. Well, the attractive one gets asked out, goes to the football game, goes for burgers and fries and a shake afterward, and looks over, and about six or seven banquettes over is the roommate with three, four, five, six of her girlfriends. And she would do anything to exchange places, but there she is. Nobody asked her. So I say, do you mind if Brenda or Colleen or whatever, do you mind if she comes along? And as Kathy says, the answer to that will tell you a lot about the guy. Sure, why not? You know, the last time we talked, she's a fun person, and I don't know her very well. Good idea. But if he says, no, I want to be alone with you. I want to get to know you. Uh-oh, red lights. So suggest a threesome. There's safety in three or more. So, and the second thing that bothers me, one and one is wide open to blackmail. Because by the second time, he's picked up the check for the football game and for the burger and fries, and one kiss seems an appropriate way to say thank you. The second time is two kisses. Four times along, you're still exploring and wondering a little bit what the guy is like. You have some questions about his taste in music, the way he speaks about other girls, a little bit coarse, so you're not too sure, but it's four times along and he starts groping. So what do you do? And what happens is that invariably, your body is way ahead of what your heart is willing to say. And dates work from the inside out, not from the outside in. You capture a girl's heart, and then in marriage, eventually the body becomes yours. You work from the inside out. Dating works from the outside in. It's deadly. Don't go there.
Let me add one more thing, and then I would be curious if there are other opinions on it as well, as any other ideas. But one of the things that we've been talking about at Snowden is getting just the girls together and getting just the guys together and really building esprit de corps with them to say, okay, girls, what are the things that we're struggling with here? And begin to build within them something of belonging to each other and taking, you know, therefore taking responsibility, being a community amongst them and just teaching them, you know, what is beauty in God's opinion? Because they're bombarded, as you know. The media just bombards them with what beauty is, and it's so shallow and superficial. And you know, they're dressing in a sexy way because they think that's what they have to do. They think that's what's required. And the parents, in many cases, don't dare. You know, particularly if it's parents that have come out of another culture. They often don't dare to stand against their children because they think that they're out of touch, and they think, well, that's just part of being Canadian. You know, whereas growing up in America, my American mother said, no way, I don't care what the rest of the world thinks, you are not going with a dress above your knees, that's it. You know, and I'd have to live with that consequence. But a mother from another culture doesn't always know, like, what is, you know, my daughter says that's how it is. And so we, I think, almost have to spiritually parent them because their parents often don't know what the right values are. And you as a young woman, I mean, you guys as a young couple, you're a role model. It's very powerful to be a young adult in the life of a teenager, for sure. I don't know. Anybody else want to come into it to say anything else? Yeah, Peter.
I think I could count on one hand, maybe even three fingers, the number of teen dating relationships that have worked out.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that we've seen in the Song of Songs, like early on, is patience and wait.
Yeah.
And, you know, in dating, what happens so often is that guy and a girl, either one or the other or both, gives their heart away, and then it doesn't work out, and it's broken. And the next person that they end up with is ending up with a more broken person than before.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not surprising that cycle repeats itself over and over again. But patience and just waiting for the right timing, waiting and saying, you know what, I'm in high school. I'm not getting married for how many years, right? Like, so let me just wait. Let me just know that this is not the right time. I can be friends with people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, part of it is helping young people, I think, to realize that they're not missing out. You're not really missing out. I mean, so much of what we're seeing in Song of Solomon is that God is pulling out something that is fantastic and saying, this is what I want. Main problem that we have is that we accept less, we go for less, and our culture is offering young people something that is far less than what God is offering. And,
yeah.
You know, I work with university students, and I do everything in my power to convince them to wait to receive something more. You know, because even as a first-year student, knowing that they have 4 years of university, they're not going to get married as a university student. So dating someone for 4 years is hard. It's hard. I don't even know. I'm not convinced it's even natural. How does a relationship grow for 4 years without getting to the point of needing to become a physical relationship in order for it to be a good relationship? I don't know. Maybe it can happen, but it seems to me like it's unlikely. So just patience and trusting God. Mm-hmm. At the right time, God will bring along the right person. And it'll be worth the wait.
Mm-hmm. I gotta say something too.
You do.
Yeah.
If I were in your shoes, you're part of the youth too, aren't you, on Friday nights?
Yes.
Phil?
He runs the thing.
on the pedestal.
Three.
Three of you and anybody else? Anybody else here?
There's a whole bunch of them.
Yeah.
There's, but nobody else. Nobody else here. The last time I said, "Well, what would you do if you were in my shoes?" and somebody said, "Well, I'd polish them." But
which they should.
They'll be polished tomorrow. But here's an idea. Run with it. If it seems like it has some mileage for you, what can happen in youth groups, probably not yours, but what can happen is that there's the inevitable we-they mentality, the we-they, the leaders and those who are led. I'm one of the followers. There's the youth leaders, and then there's the youth. And what can work very, very well is if you identify the two or three or maybe four young men, two, three, four, five young women that others follow, that others listen to, whose opinion counts. And what you do is on a Friday night, you don't have to say a whole lot, just follow the eyes. No, the same thing you, with young people, you do the same thing you do in a board meeting. No, you follow the eyes. In a lot of churches, it doesn't have to be the pastor or the chief elder, but it's at the end of the table there is Uncle John. And if Uncle John is for it, you'd better be for it. So, and there's an Uncle John in every church. So among the young people, who are they listening to? Follow the eyes, then take those two or three or five or six, whatever, have them over for a pizza one evening and change their self-perception and say, now we like to make a case for group relationships and getting away from the dangers, the attractions and the dangers of one-on-one. I'm going with, and that you're less than a person if you're not going with anybody. And we'd like to make a case for trying something new at Rosemont. And are you on board with this? We'll give it a week for you to mull it over, talk to us about it, email. And all of a sudden, you change their perception. These key people are leaders with you. See, and you plant leaders in the midst. And slowly on, you can change a culture. But like anything else in life, you spend 80% on the 20% that matters. Right? That's an Italian economist principle. Spend 80% of your time on the 20% that really counts. So who are the people who lead the other young people? And if you get them on board, let's try something new. Let's make a case. And what I did, no dating, I suggested this to the University of San Diego some years ago. It was an intervarsity group of 150. And I spoke at a summer camp, and they said, Hank, we're going to try this. We're going to try this. And the exec, there were 8 to 10 men and women on the executive committee, and they said, we're going to try this. No dating group and no email in those days yet. This is pre-Beatles. they wrote me in May and said, we really tried it for 1 year. It didn't work for us. So fair enough. You know, there's no guarantee this is going to work. It didn't work for us, but they were willing to try it for a year. So what I would do is get your key people aside and say, at least hear us out. Let us make a case, and then we're really going to look to you to run with it. So, yeah.
I'm just—it's not specifically addressing that, but kind of comes back to the question of transparency. And within the church, I have never sensed—and not particularly this church, but church in general—a sense that sex is great in marriage, and marriage is great, and that relationship is. Like, as you started with that as the objective, and it's this great objective. And I wonder if us being more transparent about marriage and our overall sexuality and that being the good thing, that young people would have something to look forward to as opposed to boring old people potentially not having sex anymore after they get married. Like this, yeah. This picture of,
yeah.
You guys don't look like you're having any fun, but guess what? The world looks like they're having a great old time. And you guys look like old people not having sex. You're pretty boring. You're not doing anything. And I don't know, like, I know my responsibility in the sense of I want to be real if young people ask us. And when it comes to New Bill students, I'm very real about, yeah, we fight, but there's a lot of great stuff about our marriage, too. And trying to say there is something to look forward to, but a lot of them have been exposed to Christian boring, not having sex, or bad sex, or just everything negative. So to me, we all in this room and in this church have such a responsibility to herald great sex and great marriage.
Yeah.
No, I'm serious, because otherwise the kids are kind of like, no, the only other option is MTV sex and people outside of marriage having sex, and that's fun, and we're boring still. And the reality is, no, we actually enjoy it. You know, we do have fun, but we try to be so like.
Let me try to
explain. I can just see this banner outside Rosemont. Come here for great sex.
Tomorrow morning when they sum up the conference today, give us a little clip. So make sure it's all sound.
The tape will pick it up. It's a female voice. Saying
but
that,
she doesn't
not
go to this church, thank God.
But let me get into Song of Solomon. It piggybacks on what you say, and I'll get into 7:1-10 a little bit with you. There's 5 points about 7:1-10. I'm not going to get into all five, but I'll make a few comments that are in our 7:1-10 treatment, and that is God's high value on bodies. And a little title, again, if I were in your shoes, hey? But why not a six-week series on God Opens a Body Shop? Or something clever. What is this? The place where you sell the perfumes and body?
Body shop.
Body shop. Okay, God's body shop. Because now God created Adam and Eve with bodies. His son came, not just airlifted in as a 30-year-old Superman, but all the way from one cell that split like ours did, one cell growing up into the birth process and 33 years among us, then if that were not enough, after the resurrection, it's not the spirit after the resurrection, but a body with a new dimension walking through walls, but a body that had scars, visible scars, and that still enjoyed fish and chips. So, no, there's a body. And it's a resurrection. We don't believe in the immortality of the soul. That's a Greek doctrine, by the way. That's not Christian. We believe in the resurrection of the body. And the spirits are hanging out in the waiting room until we get into the real space where God is surrounded by bodies in heaven. So it's from beginning and middle and end. It's all about bodies. And so what happens in chapter 7, you see, it's the third list. He has described her from the top down sevenfold. She has described him from the top down tenfold, and now he describes her from the bottom up tenfold. It's seven this way, ten this way. And then if you know Hebrew culture, seven is pretty safe. He stops at the breasts. Then ten is still pretty safe. Now the head to the feet, ten. But then what Solomon does, he's reclining on the cushions. She's doing the dance of the Mahanaim, comes from Genesis 32, 1 and 2. It's the ladders up and down the ladder with Jacob. And that's resurrected into a wedding dance in the 10th century. So it's a wedding dance, and he's reclining on the cushions, and she's there with transparent veils and one sandal for each foot. That's all she's wearing. And she dances, and he describes her from the bottom up. Now, unless you're from the Middle East and from Africa, you won't understand that this is safe above the waist. Africa's very relaxed. There's a story in the manual, lovely story. That 6 weeks into Zambia, along Cairo Road, Cecil Rhodes envisioned a highway from Cairo to Cape Town, all the way from Cairo to Cape Town, have the British flag flying everywhere in Africa, right? So Cairo Road splits Lusaka. It's a four-lane divided. And on Saturday morning, a very attractive young lady, late 20s, walked toward me with twins. And at the same time, on a Saturday morning, people everywhere, both twins got hungry. Not a problem. And she was breastfeeding as she was walking toward us. And Kathy said, put the camera away. But no problem. A Kodak moment, right? So, but here she came, very relaxed above the belt. But above the belt, I never saw African skin. We went to conferences and the chitenge skirt would be wrapped around, including the ankles. There's a very guarded sense, a private sense below the belt, but more relaxed above the belt. So here we're at a new stage of the relationship. It's not 7, it's 10. And he begins from the bottom and works his way up. He starts with the sandals, then works his way up. And some of the translation is misleading because the translators don't want to say what the text actually said. It is so candid. But there's body parts there. And he appreciates what he sees and he affirms it. So if you start there with a godly view, a heavenly view of the fact that God did not create spirits, but a body that Adam could see and say, boy, God, you've done it. This is wonderful. So start with that, with a body image. And I'm told that there's not a person in Hollywood, including the three non-stars, Lindsay Lohan, Brittany Pierce, and Spears, and who's the other one?
Paris Hilton.
There's not even the other three of them. If you put in front of a mirror and said, is there something about yourself you'd like to change? There's always something you'd like to change. A bit more of this, a bit less of that. Instead of being, as Kathy mentioned earlier, I'm very happy in my own skin. No, then you're sexy. I'm very happy to be in my own skin. And unless the girls get there, and the Snowden girls tell us, and the leaders are really struggling with this, that the obsession of the girls is their physical appearance and to be going with somebody. Now, this is number one and two on their wish list. Now, to improve their appearance ever so slightly so that he'll look at me twice. So, and the leaders are asking us, how do we get past this? You're the experts in marriage. Fix this. So, but you start with being happy with the body God gave you and with nutrition and exercise and rest. You know, your three allies. You keep the body in good shape. Those are your three allies. Obviously, you have to be sensible, nutrition, exercise, and rest. But then you're happy with the way God made you. Now, that's where it starts. So that's why Solomon is full of body parts, but it's an indication of spiritual character truths that are lying underneath this. And then near the tail end of 7, 1 to 10, they're back and forth, and your breasts are like clusters of coconuts on top of the palm, and I'm going to climb the palm and have myself a good time, he says. And she says, let the wine flow over our lips as we're sleeping. And they go to sleep kissing each other. And then the tail end, 7:10, she says, he loves me and his desire is for me. I belong to him and his desire is for me. So there's those three, I belong, or he belongs to me, I belong to him. That changes to I belong to him, he belongs to me. Then 7:10 is the third in this little trinity. He loves me for who I am and his desire is for me. So she's totally secure. And then they go home again from 7:11 to 8:4. They go home for another week. And did I tell you about this Ethiopian? I think at one of the tables. I'll give you a little peek into 7:11, 8:4. Because she says, in the home country, Solomon, we're going to be in territory that has some privacy about it. There's places in my country that are not very well inhabited. There's lonely places. There's glades. There's views. And I'm going to give you my love there. And I've stored up for you treasures in lovemaking, both old and new. She says, I've stored up treasures in lovemaking, both old, the familiar stuff that I know you like, I know how to please you, and I've got some surprises up my sleeve for you. So when our Ethiopian friend said that, they had said in the first week, Mr. Pot, does this song have anything to say about FGM? I said, FGM, enlighten me. I haven't a clue what that means. Feminine genital mutilation. Feminine genital mutilation. And in that college where we taught, 330 students, 40% of all the women had been deprived of their clitoris and their pleasure-making center. 40%. So this young gentleman said, does a song have anything to say? I had the sudden wisdom, it's not always there, but sometimes it's airlifted in, and I said, well, I'm not going to give you a Western answer to this. The song will either address this or it won't. Let me know by the last week if the song has done its work. Because the text is the teacher. I'm not the teacher, the text is the teacher. So in the last week, he put up his hand, and he said, what I see is that the young lady both took the initiative in lovemaking, and she really enjoyed it. And if that's true, that is dynamite for our people. And I said, yes, it is. Go for it. You see how the song can just serve in that way to change a whole cultural mindset. So does that run a little bit with what you started? Yeah. So I'm getting into the 7 and 8 stuff on the sly, right?
I think that you actually, this is just me, but every church should have some authorities on Song of Solomon that there should be a Song of Solomon class going all the time, like that the church is just immersed in what does God say about sexuality. Now, I think a lot of this, our problems would be taken care of if we knew how positive God was, that he invented it, that he made us, men and women, for this. I think that's...
We're all being bombarded with messages.
All the time.
Every day.
Yeah.
Every billboard, everything.
Yeah.
Yet, coming to church, we're not as bombarded.
Yeah.
So that, to me, is... And just even each other, just ensuring that even the young people hear positive messages about sex within their mm-hmm. and that it is a good thing.
Yeah.
And that it's something...
There's a little wedge, in the door that I'm going to march through. You have something else to say? Okay. I'm going to march through there. Genesis, it took me a long, long time to see this. In fact, I didn't see it. No, somebody else pointed this out to me, and, it takes a while for some things to click. But somebody said to me, you've given the Genesis 2, 18 to 25 talk quite often. We love Genesis 1 and 2. And you know how Genesis 1 and 2 are constructed, right? There's two creation stories. At the end of both, there's a man and a woman. And God says now where he values his creation. At the end of the first story, there's a man and a woman. Both are with their arms lifted in praise to God, a man and a woman, a male and a female. But at the end of 2, there's still a man and a woman, but it's like this, the man, and it's like this, the woman. And you say, wait a second, where's the other two arms? Well, they're holding hands, you see, because the man and the woman are now husband and wife. So at the end of 1, there's a male and a female. At the end of 2, there's a male and female who are now husband and wife. And that relationship is described in 2, not so much in 1. And one thing that happens, a person told me, said that, did you notice that the only creature that God made that has a sexual relationship face to face is mankind? See, if you've grown up on a farm, all Africans know their animals. And if you've grown up on a farm, animals do it as a sense of urgency. There's a sense of urgency about it. They produce little leopards and baboons and all the rest. And to this date, it's reasonably certain that an animal, be it a zebra or a dog or your neighborhood cow, turns to the partner and says, was it good for you? Or, I'm getting tired of being treated like a sex object. See, that's not animal talk. That's human talk. We're the only creatures who have that sex relationship face-to-face so we can see each other's eyes and talk about what we're experiencing voice-to-voice. For the animals, it's strictly a physical relationship. For us, even though the body parts may be similar, the anatomy may be crossing over, it is highly spiritual. It is highly spiritual, and there's a measure of control that I have so that there's a spiritual gift of self-control, and I have a relationship, and we're close enough to Africa now that I get away with this stuff. They say to me, Brother Potts, just we can hear it from you. Now, we've invested in Africa. They now see us as Africans, and Canada is a place we visited 6 months a year. It's actually quite lovely. But I dare to stand in front of an audience now the way I couldn't the first time, and I say, Now, are we growing men or cowards around here? And I see a lot of cowards that have no self-control. You're like animals. You say, this is my right. Sex is not a right. It's a privilege. It's a privilege. It's not a right. It's face-to-face. And unless you can look somebody in the eye and say, I love you and I'm committed to you, keep your pants on. It is not a right. It's not an urge that you cannot control. That is rubbish. And they can take it from us. See, in Genesis, it's already a clue. This is a spiritual relationship. The highest horizontal relationship that you can experience. So, see, that's where it starts. And young people can easily grow up with an animal sort of approach. I have these needs. How can I express these needs outside of marriage? Now, is masturbation okay? You've been through that one. And how in the world can I last till 25 or 30, or in some cases until 18 without having sex? Everything out there says that you're less than a man. Well, a man has self-control. Self-control. And if he doesn't, then his spiritual fruit tree is stunted. Right? So be firm, but smile as you're firm. Another question? Maybe what we could do is if we skip this and skip this and skip this. Skip and skip and skip. It's good stuff. Do you want to say a word about the books, and then we'll do a little bit of work with this one?
Well, just to say that we do have books. I don't know if we have enough for everybody, but the books are, it's 15? Yeah, the books are $15 each. And basically, you would have everything that we've covered today, as well as like questions, so you could do it as a Bible study, and a lot of other resources as well. But it would give you something to refer back to so that you could, you know, just do some more. And it really would be cool. I know you've done Song of Solomon before, but we would be so pleased if you were able in a year or two to do it again, take some more people, those people that didn't come today, say, hey, you know, I know you missed it, but there's another chance. We're going to do it again. And then you guys could do it yourselves. And to do it even with the youth, to figure how could we take Song of Solomon, what parts of it could we teach them? If we don't do all of it, what could we teach them? Because wouldn't that be the best, you know, protection against a bad thing, is to show them the good thing? So they'll be the back there. And before you leave, if you would like one, we would be glad to give you one for $50.
Yeah, if there's 7 copies I think we have left. There's another box of 50 on the way from South Africa, so we'll find a way for you to sign up. You can sign up, and then as soon as the box comes, we'll find a way to get the copy to you. But the nice thing about that is that not only it expands all the teaching and all the stories, but it has lots of really neat cartoons. Some great cartoons. Yeah. Okay, let's touch on the final passage, and then we'll call it quits for today. We'll end with 8 to 14. There's the symphony of married love, the sharing of married love, splendor of married love, and the source of married love. Symphony and sharing and splendor and source. And all of this happens at the symphony, sexual symphony, the sharing. It's a very intriguing passage, 7:11 to 8:4. They're on a vacation in Lebanon, a holiday. The splendor is a 3-verse poem. Love is as strong as death, and the waters will come, but they will not overcome. It's like fire. You cannot put a price tag on love. You put a price tag on prostitution, but not on marriage. There are some amazing stuff. 7 things, by the way. The splendor of married love, that poem in 8:5 to 7, and then 8 to 14. all of this happens within the commitment of marriage. That's why I say married, 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 married. And one thing I should have mentioned earlier, this is my favorite quote in probably all of Song of Solomon. I love this quote. I invite you to love it too. It's Dietrich Bonhoeffer's niece. Dietrich Bonhoeffer's niece in 1941, who was going to get married. Her uncle was already in prison for his views against the Nazi regime, the Aryan race, the Übermensch, and all of that nonsense. And Bonhoeffer said, that's not pleasing to the God that I know. He was put in jail. He never escaped. He died in jail. But his niece said, would you do the wedding service and write the sermon? Somebody else will do the steps, but you write the sermon for my wedding if you would. And he said, I'd be glad to. So he wrote the message. It was smuggled out of prison, and it was read at his niece's wedding. And one comment that Bonhoeffer made to his niece was, please remember, whatever her name was, Brunhilde or something German, please remember that your love will not safeguard your marriage, but your marriage will safeguard your love. See, we think that love is what keeps the marriage alive. It's the marriage that keeps the love alive. And he had that distinction perfectly down. You know, my marriage goes up and down depending on how loving I feel and on her reaction to my attempts to be loving. But no, the commitment is in place. That's the rock bottom. And then we sail the seas of the relationship knowing that we're in this thing for keeps. The marriage sustains the love. It's not that the love sustains the marriage. And the distinction is crucial. We have a young sister. This is weird. We have a young sister, and her breasts have not yet grown. What shall we do for our sister for the day she is spoken for? If she's the wall, we'll build towers of silver on her. If she's the door, we'll enclose her with panels of cedar. I am a wall, and my breasts are like towers. Thus I have become in his eyes like one bringing contentment. Solomon had a vineyard in Baal Haman. He let out his vineyard to tenants. Each was to bring for its fruit 1,000 shekels of silver. But my own vineyard is mine to give. The 1,000 shekels are for you, O Solomon. The 200 are for those who tend its fruit. You who dwell in the gardens with friends and attendants, let me hear your voice. Come away, my lover, and be like a gazelle or like a young stag on the spice-laden mountains. What in the world is going on there? This takes a second or a third or a 15th reading, right? It's a very interesting passage. But the same brothers who appear in the first chapter now appear again in the last chapter. They're around in the first chapter. They don't come off very well. Now they come off a whole lot better in the last chapter. The brothers are part of the bookends of the book, the Song of Solomon. They appear in chapter 1. They appear again in chapter 8. And they say, we have a young sister, say the brothers. This is a flashback. You're familiar with that from the movies. We have a young sister, and her breasts are not yet grown. She's a preteen. What shall we do for our sister for the day she is spoken for? In other words, how do we prepare her for the day that she leaves our care, our supervision in the father's absence, and the day that she's spoken for, and a husband will step in and assume care for our sister? And until that day, what do we do? What do we do? Do we follow the 21st century? And as John has indicated, say, whatever. Whatever. She makes her own choices. She makes her own bed and lies in it, or whatever phrases that we use. Hey, it's up to her. They say no. What shall we do for our sister for the day she's spoken for? She has a fork in the road. She has a choice to make. If she's the wall, we will build towers of silver on her. If she's the wall, there's a defense that says, I'm going to protect myself and keep myself from all unworthy comers, all those who want to use me, all those who want to abuse me, all those who are after sex and the wrappings, the outside, and not for the person and explore, which takes more time and effort, but those who want to take a quick shortcut and get me in bed. I'm a wall for all those kinds of advances. Then we'll build towers of silver on her. We'll affirm her. We'll praise her. We'll say, well done. We'll invest in some balloons and firecrackers and have a party. Well done, sister. You've done so well. And we'll celebrate her relational victories. Hey, will celebrate her relational victories. So when she says no to a jerk, we're going to throw her a party. Now, that's very contemporary. It's very lovely. But if she's a door, we might say in the 21st century, if she's a revolving door, anybody can get in. Then, instead of saying, we couldn't help it, she has her own choices, what could we do? Oh, no, 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 no. If she's a door, we'll enclose her with panels of cedar. We're going to build some protection around her until she's more wise and more ready to make godly and informed choices. So if she's a wall, we're going to build towers of silver, party time. If she's a door, we'll enclose her with panels of cedar because her welfare is connected with ours. She's family. She's part of us. And we're going to help her to make informed and good decisions. And she says, brothers, thank you. Thank you. I am a wall. I face that fork in the road. I am a wall. And my breasts are like towers, towers of defense, saying no to all comers. And so the right one is led across the drawbridge and across the moat and into the castle because the Solomon was the right one. And she says in a beautiful little humor touch, if you know your Hebrew, of course, you can laugh here. But she says, thus I, the Shulamith, have become in his eyes, Shulamo, like one bringing shalom. And it's a triple play on words that was very amusing to the original audience. I, the Shulamith, have become in Shulamo's eyes like one bringing shalom. Shalom, that total sense of well-being. Remember, David had blood on his hands. He was not allowed to build the temple. Solomon was the king of peace. She's Shulamo, the female counterpart, and together they experienced total shalom. So, she expands. Solomon had a vineyard in Baal Hamon, in southern Lebanon probably, or northern Galilee. He let out his vineyard to tenants. Each was to bring for its fruit 1,000 shekels of silver. And now, a lot of ancient tablets have come to light in which, this is so wonderful that scripture is always a step ahead of the archaeologists. Now, we're simply trying to catch up with what these 40 authors in scripture already said. And they stifle a yawn and say, glad, thank you for catching up. It's wonderful stuff. All these tablets have come to light. When vineyards or other agricultural fields are let out, it was a 5-to-1 ratio. 5 would go back to the lender, and the 1 and the 5-to-1 ratio would be kept by those who were the tenants. It was a 5-to-1 ratio in all the tablets, and they had a lot of agricultural tablets in the ancient Near East. So he let each was to bring for his food 1,000 shekels of silver. My own vineyard is mine to give. So she has a choice. My own vineyard is mine to give. 1,000 shekels are for you, O Solomon. I voluntarily give myself to you. And 200 are for those who tend its fruit. One of the very few scripture references to the bride price or lobola. Here you go. Africans love this. Now this is a reference to lobola. 200 are for those who tend its fruit. Solomon, I would not be your partner, your wife, the one that you're just enthralled by and that you'd like to hang out with and like to talk to. And the conversation is interactive, it's challenging, the sex is wonderful, and what a partner. You're a wonderful lover, you'll grow to be a queen. This is all good. And she says, but I wouldn't be here without my brothers guiding and nudging and helping me to be the kind of wife that I can be to you today. And without that promise for the future, unless that protection had been there in the past, we never would have crossed paths. So would you mind giving 200 shekels to the brothers who were part of the preparation of the bride that you married so recently? 200 are for those who tend its fruit. So what we like to say is that a marriage doesn't start when it starts. It doesn't start when it starts. It starts very early. I like to say as soon as the news comes in your little contraption or the doctor's report, Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so, you are expecting, at that moment, you can start to pray for his or her future husband or wife. That's a really great time to start praying for, and some people prefer to know if there's a boy or a girl hiding inside. You know, what are we in for? Some wish to know early. I love the element of surprise. We didn't know it would be boy, girl, girl, girl. It's perfect. It's worked out very nicely for us. We love our son. Love the 3 daughters, and the 4 of them just love to hang out together, all in California. They hang out every weekend together. So they're getting on well. So we love our boy, girl, girl, girl. We didn't know. We could have known because there's different little signs. This is a sidebar, hey? But they discover that little boys inside, lots of movement, lots of action, but it's arms and legs. It's arms and legs and arms and legs. And Kathy said when she was really starting to show and Carrie was on the way, we didn't know it was Carrie, but she said, the baby's moving. Would you like to feel? So I put my ear in Kathy's tummy and he kicked me. I should have learned a few things, but so the arms and the legs, very, very active. They've also found, the documentation is there, I'm sorry about this, the girls in the womb, their most active body part is the jaw.
Go figure. Sorry. I don't know.
Yeah, arms and legs and it's the jaw. It's very interesting. But that's when you start to pray about the mate, the future mate. And if they say, well, we can, with the ultrasound here, we can spot, oh, you're expecting a son, pray for his wife. A daughter, pray for her husband. Despite my nasty words about my mother-in-law earlier on, we've had a slowly developing friendship over the years, mainly slowly. Woo. But one thing they did so wonderfully well, they have six kids, and with each one, and also with Kathy, when Kathy was on the way as their second child, first daughter, they began to pray already when she was in utero, when she was just developing. 6 weeks onwards, they started praying for the right kind of godly mate to cross her path and that she would be married wisely and well come good time. So they started praying early and well and faithfully, and look at the result.
Is that a horseshoe prayer?
Phil, of all the people that I've ever known, you're one of them. Yeah. We must do lunch sometime in 2012. Okay. So it starts early, and we developed a little scheme we use with young people that if it starts early and marriage is a very social, like her brothers are part of the picture, we developed a little seven-part scheme. We put it on the board, and it's a lot of fun with young people, that you need five and perhaps six relationships to prepare you for the seventh, which is marriage. And if you invest in 1 through 5, perhaps 1 through 6, certainly 1 to 5, perhaps 1 through 6, you'll see when we get there, you'll be far more ready for number 7. Now, 1 through 6 take time. Of course, it takes time and energy. That's why we said very early on that if either party to a upcoming marriage was not yet 20, we would not be part of the marriage. So if he was 21 and she was 18, we would say, we're not saying no to you, we're saying wait. 21, 18, we're saying wait until you're 20, we're not going to touch it because you don't have the time or energy to invest in all six relationships to make your marriage a maximum success. You're simply too young to make this thing work. When one of the two of you is under 20, the success, the failure rate in the US of A, Canada, I don't know, but 69% of marriages in their teens fail. 69 when he or she or both are in their teens. There are exceptions. So we don't touch it if either one is under 20, and unless they spend at least a year together, what Walter Trobisch calls the summer and winter together. That's a literal summer and winter, which makes for 1 year. But also summer is a good time.